Welcome to the conference. Please enter the conference ID followed by the pound key. Thank you. Guest ID accepted.
Hey, good evening, everyone. Welcome to another Tuesday night installment here at Your Remedies in the Law. Tonight, of course, we're discussing various IRS administrative remedies with our speaker, Mr. Tony Davis. My name is Mark Michaels. I'll be your host for this evening's conference brought to you by Your Remedies in the Law, which is in direct affiliation with Americans Restoring America. Before we get started with this evening, though, it is very important that I provide you with the following disclaimer.
Nothing that you hear on this call tonight may be deemed by you in any way, shape, or form to be legal advice. If you are on this call because of a situation in your life where you require legal advice, I very politely ask you to hang up the phone. Now, we don't mean to sound rude when we say this. We just want to express to everyone in no uncertain terms that anyone joining this call looking for legal advice has no place or business here. Nobody here at Your Remedies in the Law or any of the programs offered by Americans Restoring America is a lawyer, attorney, or any member of the bar. Therefore, no one here is able to offer you any legal advice. Should you require legal advice, my advice to you would be get an attorney. As for these calls, they're all just for entertainment purposes. It's just folks saying what they might do where they're similarly situated to you. You might get a little bit of education out of it, but mainly you're just going to get folks' opinions about what they might do. However educated and experienced these thoughts and opinions might be, they are just people's opinions nonetheless, and it's always up to you to do your own due diligence. All right, on to the next subject. I'd like to go over a few things here with Your Remedies in the Law, if I could, very quickly. First of all, if I can take everybody to the homepage of www.yourremediesinthelaw.com, if we look up in the upper right-hand corner, we see a little picture of the Constitution. Click on that, and you'll have a separate page come up with just two items on it. These two items are of much importance, though, especially if this is all new to you. First and most importantly on the left is the jurisdictionary course. This is your 24-hour crash course on the rules of civil procedure. Better known to some as American jurisprudence or AMJUR, the rules of civil procedure are essentially the foundation or structure upon which all law in America rests. So to have a firm and thorough understanding of these rules means to have at least a basic understanding of what's going on in virtually any court scenario that you find yourself in. On the right is the common law default process, mostly known for its high national win rate in most traffic cases throughout the country. At least that's what it's most popularly acquired for. But that is not really why it's on this page. The reason that we have it up here with the jurisdictionary course is when you go through it, you'll notice that it utilizes a lot of the same fundamental procedures that you learned about in the jurisdictionary course. So it kind of acts as a real-life homework assignment. Also, for a lot of folks, it's their first time committing to action. Folks seem a little more willing to take that first step, probably because of such a high success rate and traffic scenarios being such a common interest in this country today. The common law default, although known majorly for traffic purposes, has many other. Truly, it's for most scenarios that you may find yourself in where there's no damage to property or person. It's just some entity is claiming you broke a rule, therefore you must pay a civil penalty. Both of these items are very affordably priced, the jurisdictionary with a contribution of $250 and the common law default at $150. Also on the subject of Your Remedies in the Law, most of you are probably familiar now with Americans Restoring America. Every time you visit the homepage of yourremediesinthelaw.com, you are met with that blue box that pops up asking if you'd like to continue on to the site that you were visiting or stay and visit Americans Restoring America. The reason that we've done this is very simple. We're trying to get folks to explore. There are multiple information providers talking about multiple subjects, as well as many other features and study groups at Your Remedies in the Law. And Your Remedies in the Law is just one of a couple dozen websites that all together make up Americans Restoring America. So there's quite a bit for you to see, and we hope that you'll do just that at your leisure. If you have any questions about whether or not we have an information provider that could give you their personal educated opinion about your particular situation, get a hold of us at yourremediesinthelaw.com, and we'll be happy to assist you in any way that we can. Statewide communications. If you're not already a member, please do sign up. Tell your friends and family about it. That's that map of the United States that you see on virtually every site that we have. It's a private communications platform that enables folks to speak with one another on a local level based on a very strict predecided topics of discussion. Essentially, how it works is this. A wizard will walk you through a very easy setup. You know, put your name in here, click next. Put your zip code in here, click next, that sort of thing. Then it will walk you through the remainder of the setup. And then you get to a point where it will ask you, what are your hot points interested in? This could range anything from credit card issues, home foreclosure, IRS matters, asset protection, or maybe veterans' rights, maybe personal health rights, anything that you can think of. And if it affects your personal rights, you should find it in that list or something that's close enough. When the setup is complete, it puts it all together, much of how you think of a social network. Though nothing like a social network. It's very custom. It's very private. But it then puts you in contact with people in your local area that have similar interests to you. The idea here is to put the power of education and communication back in the hands of the common man. If you are in need of legal advice or you need someone to represent you, you're going to have to get an attorney. It's just that simple. But if there was a way, a private place that you could go to discuss matters, your personal opinions, their personal opinions, with people that were like-minded, maybe you jump online one day and you say, this happened to me today. First person comes back and says, well, I disagree with that. I don't think that they should be able to do that. I don't think that's fair. Well, that's probably not going to be a tremendous amount of help to you. Maybe the next person comes on and says, well, I'll tell you what I would do were I similarly situated. I'd watch these YouTube videos, and then I'd go down there to my local county courthouse, go to the law library, get a law dictionary, and look at these terms. Maybe the next person after that says, those all sound like great ideas. I'd also go to this particular website and check out these educational materials that might assist you in your learning. And then for you to go and do some due diligence on what you're reading, just people's suggestions, people's opinions at all. But if you did some due diligence and educated yourself, maybe the farther you got into it, you discovered that it's not as difficult as you initially thought it would be because you're focused on one single subject. And you get to the point where you've educated yourself, and now you're handling your own affairs, your own matters. Well, folks, there's nothing illegal or unlawful about that. And that's all we're trying to do here at Statewide Communications is just very simply get people to start talking again. Of course, there's no cost to you for using Statewide Communications, either signing up or the regular using of it. And so we hope that you'll pass that around. Freedoms Radio. If you're over the road, you don't want to deal with the call process, maybe you're just new to your remedies in the law, and you don't yet have your username and password, therefore you can't see the phone number and the PIN. By the way, if you'd like to pick up a membership to your remedies in the law, it's very easy. You just simply click the register button. Fill out your basic information there. You'll enjoy the first 30 days for free to evaluate it. After that, it converts to a very affordable $10 a month on your credit card or your PayPal. But every single call is recorded. You have years of archives to go through, a vast wealth of knowledge, as well as many other wonderful features. But if that's not an option for you today, you have freedomsradio.com. Every night, the calls go out over the air at 9 p.m. Eastern live. There's also the question bar there where you can type in a question, click submit. As long as that's during call hours, that will pop up on the moderator screen, and we do our best to read every single one of those questions out over the air as long as they are appropriate. So you don't get the one-on-one with the information provider like you would be by being a private member, but you do get your questions answered. There's no cost to utilize Freedoms Radio, so no matter where you are or your circumstances, you never have to miss a call again if you don't wish. All right, winding down here, I'd like to go over one last bit of housekeeping. This is your caveat emptor, or your buyer beware. For any purchase that you may make, if your remedy is in the law or any of the other sites underneath the umbrella of Americans Restoring America, when you come aboard and you go with an information provider, you are doing just that. Information provider's famous director for advertising at your remedy is in the law. This payment would be an expense to that information provider along with any other expenses that they might have associated with your particular product or service. When you contact us, all we simply do is listen to your particular scenario, quickly deduce from a list of folks that honestly most of you would probably never be able to find on your own just simply because they can't be found. Can we make those introductions? Not every part on the information provider is always going to be successful. Everybody always scheme for the best. But unavoidable things do sometimes happen. And when they do, you have to roll with them and deal with them as you would with anything else in life. And we also want to emphasize, though, that the intent is always to be successful. If you have any questions of that, we welcome you to visit www.yourremedyisinthelaw.com/testimonials and see what others have to say about these products and services. Now, let's touch very quickly on the subject of refunds or the refund policy. There is none. Not if the remedy is in the law, anyway. Of course, when you come aboard and you go with a particular information provider, again, that is exactly what you're doing. So any discussion of a refund or a credit would be a strict and private matter between you and the information provider, and even then, that's very few and far between. It must be extenuating circumstances. You are expected to have done your due diligence before you commit to any particular process or information provider's time. All right, lastly, pertaining here to all of the information providers at Your Remedies in the Law, we'd like you to remind everybody that all of our speakers at these conferences are our guests and should be treated with the highest level of respect. If you disagree with something that a speaker has to say, that's fine. Disagreeing is how we learn, but please, you must always be civil. Besides, if we can dispose properly and then answer properly, then we can all learn something from it. All right, that is my ramble for this evening, folks. Tonight's speaker
is Mr. Tony Davis. Tony's going to be...
No, it's not. it's not Tony Davis. It's Brother John. Recording just went a second over long. Anyways, those things happen. Tonight's going to be a very interesting story. We're going to hear from Brother John with regards to the relationship of the United States of America's Constitution and number 57 with the Declaration of with a direct reference to the Declaration of Independence. Now, I've tried to figure out what number 57 is. Is that Hines? What? So without further ado, we're going to get John to answer that question, and then also, hopefully, we'll have time tonight for a foray into a special request regarding the all-cap name and subrogation with regards to an oversimplified terms of insurance industry deals and contracts and so forth. So without further ado, it's my pleasure to turn the call over to Brother John.
Thank you for your very kind introduction, Michael. Thank you. there was a time, a long, long time ago in a galaxy far, far away at an island across the pond, to the north and to the east where, individuals who of honor and heart sought to do the best they could, the best way they knew how, against unbelievable odds, and in environments where the land was so little, and so there was so little of it, and the owners were so few, what happened was is there other individuals had to fight for a position, not just necessarily in a government, but with the landowners. And to that end, they were subjugated to the landowner, and if the landowner didn't like what they were doing, he just simply kicked them off his land, which meant that much of what happened to them was at the whim of the landowner and not necessarily a cause of law. And this became rather challenging in that sometimes one landowner's parcel was bordered by others that were of similar mind, and if someone didn't like what they were doing and they attempted to leave, what happened was that the adjacent landowners would prevent them from crossing their property. And it sometimes was in a very, very tough situation, especially when you come up through the 11th and 12th and 13th centuries, where we had many, many cruel tyrants that couldn't, the length and the width and the breadth of their audacity and tyranny could not even be measured. Some that believed that in the 11th century that the unpleasant individuals could be bred out of a genealogy. And to that end, there was a practice called prima nupta, or first night, that was instituted that amongst individuals, primarily the Scottish, who were very resentful of any intervention from the south there and the related kings. They and the idea was that they would have, and any married couple on the honeymoon night, they would have right of first night with the bride, which meant that invariably over a third to half of them became pregnant with children that were not of their line, but of the property owner's line. And the individuals, they placed a great weight on genealogy, and to that end, most of the genealogies, they believed, were specific and direct assignments from God himself. And when the great plagues of Europe struck, they and individuals that were wealthy enough to afford silverware and eat off of it and use the silver utensils to eat off, a lot of times their teeth would just barely scratch the utensil while they were pulling the fork or that knife or spoon from their mouth. And just enough of that silver would come off that their body had a resident amount of silver in it, so that at the time of the great plagues, it's strange how the clergy and the aristocracy, the wealthy, didn't suffer an immediate predisposition toward the onset of the plague. And there, since then, medical technology and physiological technology has brought up the fact that silver is a natural antimicrobial, and what happens is that amongst these the many issues of being using for currency, it also can be used for good health. And there are many individuals that avoid the regular pharmacological solutions and resolutions in favor of non-pharmacological, in this case, silver, ionic silver, colloidal silver. There's a lot out there. But in the days of the ignorance, these folks believed that this was some type of act of God, and they portrayed themselves as quote-unquote blue bloods, you know. And to that end, what happened was, is when you had an overabundance of silver in your diet, your skin would take on an odd bluish tint. And this anomaly, which this speaker himself personally knows more than one individual, actually quite a few individuals that use an excessive amount of silver in their diet, to the point where at times in their lives it had turned their tissue blue. And the term blue blood doesn't even begin to apply. Blue skin, you know. But what happened was is that this was held over the individuals that didn't have, couldn't have, or would never be a landowner unless they were found the favor of someone who was a landowner and they were granted lands entitled to that. And to that end, that meant that many individuals, the tyranny that they were, that they were subjugated to almost genetically, but through all the generations, would never, ever, 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 could ever be resolved in that environment, because they realized that as the individual proceeded, there's never an increasing flood of dissipation where the landowners and the rulers and their families and their descendants didn't have a tremendous track record of improving, but they it was dissipation, and the attitudes became worse, and the more entrenched in the arrogance that befell them, especially when any time a medical predisposition befell the country, these blue bloods seemed to be almost unbelievably immune to any subjugation to the disease. And so to that end, when it was heard that this Spaniard had discovered a new world, he many people believed in their hopes that this might be an opportunity for them to change some of this tyranny, and at least maybe not necessarily for themselves, but for their children. And many of these individuals did just that. They sold themselves into slavery so that their children could get board passage to the new world. Others, families, portions of the families, not having any other asset than to sell themselves into slavery in that country, did so to be able to fund others coming to the new world. And after coming to the new world, this wasn't just an event where the English titled citizens were coming here. Spain was also, and other countries, and the French. But what happened was that Spain didn't quite follow their ships and their citizens quite like Great Britain did. Great Britain followed their citizens to the point where it was such that they began to send emissaries over to the New World in great droves to be able to keep an eye on them. But there was something called the East India Trading Company. And at that time, this East India Trading Company, owned by the British, they traveled all over the world, and they were somewhat of the monarch of the sea, and they were able to afford the building of ships, and I don't mean just small ships, great ships, tall ships, sometimes not just two main masts but three main masts, and up to 17 or 19 sheet or sail aboard these great ships, so that they could maintain great speed. And because individuals saw the East India Trading Company as a potential asset for plundering, they began to try to make defensible ships out of these, including large cutters that had cannons and guns aboard, and they now began to carry just huge amounts of dynamite. And the East India Trading Company, primarily comprised of the of wealthy individuals that not just were wealthy but had position in Parliament, in the House of Royals and the House of Commons. And so what transpired was that these individuals, having great sway with the government of the time, i.e. the crown, went about the world armed to the teeth, driven by greed, and a level of arrogance that transcended belief. Many times some individuals would uprise on a ship and overtake it and take it over and waylay the captain or any loyal crew to the crown, and they would begin to go back and go after others using the spoils of the of what they had already acquired, including the dynamite, the cannons, and the cannonballs that they had acquired when they took over the ship. These folks began to be known as pirates. What happened was that they also began to be feared by the crown. The crown got very, very strong in its emphasis of keeping their position and their threat worldwide very, very viable and verifiable, meaning that they any kind of uprising, they treated it with the most severe consequences and response that they could possibly do so. And all over the world, they began to fear the British crown. And when British sails with a British flag came into harbor, there were many people that knew what that meant, and they were very, very fearful. The East India Trading Company began to sell tea from China to the American colonies without paying taxes, apart from those imposed by something called the Townsend Acts. And the Townsend Acts or Townshend duties were part of British Acts of Parliament that were passed in 1767 through 1768, introducing a series of taxes to fund administration of the British colonies in America. And they were their purpose was exclusively to extract taxes from the colonists not just for the support of the administration of the colonies, but to be returned to England. It was intended to be an income source. One of the biggest taxes was the tax on tea. And the other importers, against the pleasantness of, or unpleasantness of the East India Trading Company, didn't believe in that and weren't party to paying those taxes. And the a basic part of Parliament was that paying of tax was something that without representation was something that the British didn't put up with. The problem was is that a lot of those British citizens that came over here, now when due to the Townsend Acts, the individuals were being forced to pay taxes without any representation, without enumeration, etc. Subjugation into paying taxes that they had no desire to pay. The colonists were not well flush with military prowess, let alone ships and boats of military nature. Although there were a few ships that were acquired from Spain under proper pretenses financially, America had very few, and their shipbuilding industry had not yet developed into what it could or should be. So it was any time a large boat came into port, that was a clear and present danger with an immediate threat, and it was a threat to life. And what happened was that those individuals, however, coming across on that boat, the British rule over the colonists was something that the Americans would not take tyranny lying down or just by looking the other way. It came such to the point where the British regularly, individuals that even suggested an opposition to the tax, they were the British governors of the day would literally have those individuals put in stocks and If you're not familiar with what a stock is, that's a single post sticking straight up out of the ground that has a T-bar on it that has three holes in it and an upper bar that these three holes are drilled half through the lower, half through the top. There's a hinge on one side and a latch on the other. And they would put the individual's head and their hands through these stocks, and they would put them on public display, and this was their punishment. And they would be locked by a lock with a key that only the British proconsul had or the British governor had, which meant that if you didn't immediately come into conformance with what they demanded, it was the gallows. And then if you're not familiar with the gallows are, that was usually a large horizontal beam supported by beams on either side by with which ropes were fastened. And they would have individuals standing on either a support or a horse, and they would put a noose around their neck and then shoo the horse off. Now, unlike what you see in the later movies in the coming in the 17th century and the early 18th century, these gallows were not well perfected in nature, and sometimes an individual would dangle by their neck for hours before they died. Later on, they made certain that when they were hung, you know, they had a trap door by with which an individual would fall at least 4 to 6 feet, developing some velocity so that when the rope snapped tight, it snapped the neck. That was very merciful compared to this. This was not. Individual would remain there screaming and writhing in pain for hours, and sometimes there's records where one individual lasted over 3 days dangling in the gallows before he died. This was very, very threatening. What happened was that the individuals in December 16, 1773, at Griffin's Wharf in Boston, Massachusetts, American colonists frustrated with and angry at Britain for imposing taxation without representation, dumped 342 chests of tea imported by the British East India Trading Company into the harbor. The event was the first major act of defiance by the to the British by rule over the colonists, and it showed Great Britain that the Americans wouldn't take the taxation and tyranny sitting down, and it rallied patriots across the 13 colonies for independence. They certain movements. The Sons of Liberty in Massachusetts on December 16, 1773, instituted this. And the target was the Tea Act of May 10, 1773, which allowed the British to send the company to do what they did. Many of the individuals were disguised as indigenous Americans, or Indians, if you will, and destroyed the entire shipment of tea sent by the East India Trading Company. The demonstrators boarded the ships and threw the chests into the harbor, and the British considered the protest an act of treason and responded extremely harshly. The episode escalated into what we later would learn when we call the American Revolution. They, the Tea Party was a culmination of resistance movement throughout British America against the Tea Act tax passed by British Parliament in 1773. Although the tax was very, very small, the tyranny was something more that was the issue, not just the thing, that, the evidence of that tyranny, in this case, the tax. After the Boston Tea Party, Parliament revolved that they would respond with extreme force. And in 1774, there was something that was called the Intolerable Acts. And if you choose, you can look them up in Wikipedia. And there were four acts enacted by Parliament directly in response to the Boston Tea Party of December 16, 1773. They hoped that this would be dissuasive and cause all those that were resisting and within the 13 colonies to change their tune. These acts also, many of them, of the acts, they carried penalties that up to and including the death penalty for individuals that demonstrated any kind of even the modest insubordination. This is, remember, now we're into 1774, and the British and the Intolerable Acts or Coercive Acts, they ended self-government in Massachusetts and closed Britain's commerce or Boston's commerce forever. The colonists up and down the 13 colonies in turn responded to the Intolerable Acts with additional acts of protest, and by convening the First Continental Congress, which positioned the British for repeal of the acts and coordinated the colonial resistance against them, the American Revolutionary War was precipitated out of this the First Continental Congress and began in 1775. Five individuals at called the Committee of Five, Samuel Adams, Paul Revere, Hutchinson, William Molyneux, generated the document that would later be the Declaration of Independence. Of these men, every one of them knew that what they were asking for and what they were doing because of what transpired after the First Continental Congress, which petitioned the British government to repeal the acts, and the acts only got worse. This one was not a request. It was a declaration, a statement. They decided that against these intolerable acts, the coercive acts, they were going to stand no matter what. In spite of their position, many of them, very, very extremely wealthy, came out of the woodwork to help. There were many individuals that had been asked to help participate, but among these, some of them would not because of the threat that the British immediately posed, and the fact that they were at war with Great Britain, with the American Revolutionary War, was an oversimplification of the tyranny that was being laid at their feet, including the fact that many of those who had intended to participate were also apprehended and murdered by the British government. What happened was is that at that juncture, they said, this is enough. We have to stand up and fight. We cannot do this any longer. It is no longer considered tolerable. We must stand at the in liberty. We will not die in chains. But we will stand and we die standing, but we will not die kneeling in chains. And authors of the five that authored the Declaration of Independence, it starts out when in the course of human events it becomes necessary for one people to dissolve the political bands which have connected them to another and assume among the powers of the earth in separate and equal station to which the laws of nature and the nature's God entitled them a decent respect to the opinion of mankind requires that they should declare the causes which impel them to this separation. We hold these truths to be self-evident that all men are created equal and they're endowed by the Creator with certain inalienable rights. Among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. That to secure these rights, comma, governments are instituted of men, comma, deriving their just powers from the consent of the government, that whenever a form of government becomes destructive to these ends, it is the right of the people to alter or abolish it and to ensure new government, laying its foundations on such principles, or, and organizing its powers in such form that they shall not seem most likely to affect their safety or happiness. Prudence, indeed, will be dictate the government's long. Pardon me. I'm going to take a moment to get something to drink here. Prudence, indeed, will dictate that governments long established should not be changed for light or transient causes, and accordingly, all experience has shown that mankind are more disposed to suffer while evils are sufferable than to right themselves by abolishing the forms with which they are accustomed. But when a long train of abuses and usurpations pursuing invariably the same object evidences a design to reduce them to absolute despotism, it is their right and their duty to throw off such government and to provide new guards for their future security. They, this is extremely critically of prime importance. And when when we realize how serious the quote of Thomas Jefferson that the tree of liberty must be refreshed from time to time with the blood of patriots and of tyrants. And it's very, very important that you realize that in that letter that he wrote to William Stephen Smith in 1787, that and who is the son-in-law of John Adams, he was very, very serious. Before this, while leaving the Second Continental Congress, Benjamin Franklin was stopped by a widow and asked, "Good sir, what kind of government have you given us?" And he said, "Dear lady, a republic, if you have the temerity of character to keep it." Every one of those individuals at the Second Continental Congress were very wealthy. Temerity of character that was demonstrated by them to accomplish what they did with the unanimous support of all 13 colonies at the time that would later become the original 13 states was unbelievably hard to accomplish, and a great opposition internally to the individuals that would rather live the life of complacency and pleasantness in some level of subjugation and some level of servitude, thinking that we'll put up a little bit of servitude and, you know, the subjugation, and but we'll keep the peace. That's like an individual who walks the dividing line between good and evil, except the problem is that the dividing line that he's walking is a very, very thin line. In fact, it's not just a thin line, it's a razor blade. And eventually you walk very far down that razor blade, and your own sheer weight presses through the blade, and your person is terminated because you cannot walk that line. It's either one side or the other and live very long. And individuals that either side sometimes use that line that individuals have walked to destroy that individual, especially when the when persons that were quote-unquote American citizens but friendly to the British turned up as spies. What happened was that they used that razor blade of that sharpness of that line with the British to quietly suggest that some of them were more friendly to the colonists and were using the fact that they were reporting, quote unquote, these activities, which for their own personal gain, and that there was part of a conspiracy. They were part of individual conspiracies that would eventually turn on the individuals that they were helping, i.e. the British government. And when this information leaked out, these individuals were immediately hung, drawn, quartered, et cetera, et cetera. It was the British were neither very pleasant or pleased with individuals that that did this. And to that end, this is the way the colonists dealt with a lot of those who chose to walk the line. They would just quietly choose to use some of the acts that these individuals who were walking the line as evidence to let the masters that they were attempting to continue to serve take their own lives. And so what happened was is that that which was laid at their rest was taken from them by their own lack of commitment and propriety and some temerity of character. If you look on the back of a $2 bill, there's an engraving of the Second Continental Congress. Just to the left of center in that engraving, there are four men standing in the engraving in the background. The tallest one closest to the center, his name is Josiah Bartlett. He just happens to be my wife's great-great-great-great-great-grandfather. We may have some traceability back to that, although my side of the family never had the, quite the honor and the privilege of standing up for that liberty back then. Much of my family came from the old country only five or six generations ago. In fact, to that end, my generation is the first generation of half-breeds on my father's side. married a American, a true American. She had not only four separate ethnicities of parents or grandparents, but great-grandparents had nine ethnicities. So on my mother's side, I guess I'm a full, you know, full-blooded American. The melting pot definition definitely applies to me. My wife, her family, and some people will crack jokes that she, because she was born in Argentina and raised in Uruguay, that then she's not an American. Of course, when you identify that both her parents were working in the mission field, and she was born in the mission field as a child of natural born U.S. citizens. And that's something that we'll get into on a different night, but I'll brush across very shortly here. There's a difference between native born and natural born. Native born means you were born on U.S. soil or born to with one or at least one parent was a U.S. citizen, and that you've sought citizenship out of that relationship of the one parent that was an American citizen. However, natural born means that you are born of two parents that both of them were already citizens. Natural born or native born or naturalized, you were born of two from two parents that were already citizens. In the Constitution, it clearly delineates between individuals that are natural born, and that any one individual that should seek the presidency or the office of president or vice president must be natural born after the year of 1813. And that gave him the years that, or 1838, that gave him the years to an individual to have generations that would be natural born. And after that point, they could no longer be just native born parents or the individual native born. They had to be candidates for those position office. You had to be natural born. This was so that individuals that had come from Great Britain and quote unquote been naturalized could not achieve the throne, as it were, or the position of the presidency, and then return this country back to the slavery from which it came. And some of you will point out that neither Barack Obama or our current vice president. KDH is a neither of them are natural born. That, and you'd be correct. There's individuals that you may there's some things that are starting to brew that if you were to remove an existing president for cause, like with a writ of quo warranto, that would also require that the vice president be removed. But up until this point, there was a concern that who would be the next occupant of the office of president. And if those of you who are familiar with it look to the West, you would say, OMG, holy K-letter Batman, that would be Nancy Pelosi. And what was necessary to remove that potential threat from moving up in that position, those individuals had not, action had not been taken against him. But if you wanted to look at a brief on Kamala Debbie Harris, that provides the fact that she was not natural born, and if you wanted to, I may even be able to provide you with a default judgment that was issued out of the Southern District, U.S. District Court, Southern District for the State of California, that Kamala Debbie Harris was not qualified to stand in office. We made a little bit of a mistake. Jurisdiction for qualification for casting your for putting your application to run for office resides exclusively with the state. Now, in 1873, there was a landmark Supreme Court case where they overturned voter fraud, etc. But since then, it's been realized that qualification for the individual office of president, vice president, actually rests exclusively with the individual registrar of voters and the state in which that individual is a resident. And to that end, we learned a rule on jurisdiction a very, very hard way. And if any of you really wants a copy of that that pleading, submit your request to Michael, and I'll see that you guys, anyone who wants it, can get a copy of both the pleading and a copy of the default judgment. It's a shame that we did not have the jurisdiction delicacy figured out. No one had ever tried that. We didn't realize the issue until it was tried, and then we realized that we may not have taken the complete correct path to that end. The effort that's currently in work is not going to make the same mistake. This goes back to a call a little while back on jurisdiction, but you have to remember that if you're going to fight against it in a tyranny, you have to do so, if you intend to use the courts, to do it in a court of jurisdiction that has justiciable standing to rule upon that. Now, every one of those individuals that came to the Second Continental Congress knew, some of them traveled there very secretly because others had been murdered along the way. Even traveling to that particular meeting, there was a murder. But what happened was that they all knew that if they failed and the British government should overrule, that they would all be hung, drawn, quartered, disemboweled. There's a handful of unkind ways that they knew how to terminate an individual. And none of them were pleasant or kind. And they had a nasty habit of doing it in public. And they would take their horrible acts and make them very public to take their intolerable tyranny and further persuade individuals to subjugate themselves to that voluntarily. Of those individuals, including, I guess I would have to call it my grandfather, but it was by marriage, by one of my great-grandfathers, by marriage, they, against all odds, were able to form this new country. And they entered as leaders. Some people talk about leadership and leaders as with very flippantly, but a friend of mine who at his office, he's since passed away, but his office on base, he had completely covered three of his four walls in his office with pictures, engravings, or artifacts of one particular general. And this general fought in the Second World War very, very bravely. And he, one of his sayings was, "I'm the first on the battlefield, and I'm the last one off the battlefield, and I leave no man behind." And since then, we've heard quite a few individuals that have taken up those quotes. It, in many of the photos and engravings, he was shown not with a pistol or a rifle, but he was shown with a drawn saber on a steed or a stallion. And at one particular tank battle in the south of Germany, he was credited with not one, not two, but five tank kills. He was on his horse with saber drawn, was dancing between the panzers so that they were trying to hit him, and he would stand between them while their turrets realigned, and they jump out of the way when they fired, killing each other. And there were individuals that they were so inspired that by his heart and his bravery that they said, "I want to be just like that man." And one of those, who was just a first lieutenant at that time, would later lead a charge in Southeast Asia, now much older, at against implacable odds of almost 1-8. He would lead the charge with the saying, "What do you want to do? Live forever?" And he and his few men prevailed. He died in a later battle, but he was so inspired by the person leading that he wanted to do the same thing. Now we have generals, et cetera, that go out there and push. You know, actually, they're in bunkers. They're in offices here in the U.S. or in different countries saying, "Hey, platoon number Blue 3, go to Grid Square 47 Charlie and engage the enemy there. And Company Red Sea, advance to 134 Alpha and engage it." And you wonder if they're not just pushers rather than leaders. There's people who get up on Sunday morning and they do quote unquote worship services, but in many cases they're up there performing, or they're supposed to be leading worship, but they're up there performing and they're singing songs and people even clap. But what about the ones that entered into worship a day or two earlier and they get up there on that platform and they just continue to worship, and individuals out in the building say, "That person is undeniably worshiping the Most High King. I want to be just like them," and they enter into worship too. And it says, "The Most High King inhabits the praises of his people." And there's an old joke about this elderly couple driving into town and in this pickup, and the wife says, "You know, you realize that 45, 50 years ago when we used to drive this same route, that you used to have your arm around me and we would chat and we would snuggle on the way in?" I says, "What happened to us?" The husband kind of looks away from his driving at her and then looks back to his driving and looks back at her and says, honey, I'm still sitting in the same place. You know, and it says, the comment was, if you feel far from God, guess who moved? All of those men who, that put pen to the founding of this country, it says, we hold these truths to be self-evident that all men are created equal and are endowed by their creator. They served the Most High King. They did not care for their fortunes. Everyone except one of them died paupers that were signers of the Declaration of Independence.
On that day, July 4th, 1776, 56 men pledged their life, their wives, their children, their wealth, and knew
that the moment they put that pen, that quill, into the ink well and touched it to the Declaration of Independence, that there was no turning back.
In that moment, they stood and fought as leaders. In this case, not with guns and muskets and swords and sabers, but with a feather from a fowl that they use as a quill to make their commitment of their life and the lives of their wives, their children, their family, and their wealth to found this nation. If there was a roll call vote, how many of us would be willing to stand up and be counted as number 57? I've run 2 minutes over. I thank you for your time and your patience. Once again, we're going to turn it back over to Michael for question and answers. Although we do encourage you to, if you are able to, follow the subject matter during Q&A, during question and answer. You're not required to follow any subject matter and the one that's on your heart. Thank you for your patience and your graciousness. Back to you, Michael.
Well, thank you, John. I would dare say that there's a number of people on this call, including yours truly and yourself, that would fill in that line quickly and freely. Press star 2 on your keypad, ladies and gentlemen, to raise your hands. Press star 2 on your keypad to raise your hand. And while you're thinking about doing that, I will go to Freedom's Radio to see if we have any questions there. Again, press star 2. Don't be shy. You know I can't stand not having questions. So we'll go from there. I'm going to check Freedom's Radio while you're thinking about what? Pressing star 2. Nobody has responded. What is this? All right. Brother Kent, go right ahead.
Yes. Could we have some comments based upon what Michael from Las Vegas was saying last night on subrogation and the subsequent conversation that we had?
Why don't you give a quick, and please, operative word is quick, 30,000-foot view on what Mike from Las Vegas was talking about to bring John up to speed on it.
Okay. John, last night on the call, at the end of the call, Michael from Las Vegas, and I'll stand corrected if he's on the line and disagrees with how I'm enumerating this.
I'll tell you what, while you're doing that, I'm unmuting Michael from Las Vegas. Go ahead.
Okay. Was asking about or talking about subrogation and the all-cap name. And there was some confusion, if you will, over what subrogation itself is. And then I talked about the insurance industry and contracts and subrogation, and subsequently at Mike's request sent him a short text about how this might be discussed. I don't know. I'm not trying to put you on the spot. And so if this isn't something that you've thought about, you know, certainly we could wait for an answer. Or if you do have some comments, I'd appreciate hearing them. or if you have any questions about what either Mike is saying or what I'm saying, I would appreciate hearing the questions.
That's a good question. I am glad you asked, Ken.
Would you like an answer?
Would you be interested in an answer?
Yes. And Mike would probably be interested in an answer, too.
Okay. Okay. To that end, I'm going to give a response to that by way of a couple of questions. You ready? And on this one, not just Michael or Kent, but if you raise your hand on this, Michael will unmute you to respond to it. But does anybody know what the term all caps, what you're doing when you take a proper name and put it into all caps? What are you identifying that entity as? Anybody?
I have it.
Michael Edwards, you be quiet.
I am.
Anybody else? What does all caps mean? Pardon?
The corporation.
Ding, ding, ding. Yes, Bob, today you're today's big time prize winner. You win 64 points. No, right. But that's not all. You get to choose door number one, door number two, or Carol Barrel. That is absolutely correct. It's a corporation. When we go back to the Declaration of Independence, it says, we hold these truths to be self-evident that all men are created equal and that they are endowed by their who? Anybody?
Creator.
Creator with certain inalienable rights. Among these are life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness. So the entity is endowed by its creator, and it is, and all the rights that they have are defined by their creator. Would that be a fair assessment of the situation here?
Yes.
Okay. Now, who is the creator of corporations?
Those that allege
to be government. Is it A, the government, B, a government, or C, the government?
Those that
or D, all the above?
Those
which
that
one? This is a multiple guess test. You know, Bob, you can have anything you want to drink as long as it's Coca-Cola. You know, the answer is D, all the above. And therefore, if an individual identifies themselves with all caps and spells their name in all caps, they're identifying as a entity under and the government, or in this case, the United States, the creator of the corporations. With that in, with the moment you've done that, technically, though surreptitiously as it appears, it's not whether it's overt or not. People don't realize that, but that they have now, especially in pleadings, and there are jurists that pay attention, extreme attention to this, that if a defendant or a plaintiff identifies himself with all caps, they're identifying the corporation or the corporate account that was set up when they were born, when an individual applied for a Social Security account, that there was a corporate account set up for that individual. Now, the account was set up, but the individual was assigned corporate status in most of these cases by default without their permission. Hence the issue for our brother GW, who is working so hard to get that identification that was assigned when that Social Security account was set up changed back to a natural citizen. Capital A, lowercase NDREW, capital J, lowercase ACKSON, you know. That's a natural person. That the entity that defines that person's rights is the one, the all powerful intelligent designer that in this case the founding fathers referred to as their creator. And whatever delineation you want to give to this entity, whether you want to call him God, Yahweh, space aliens, spirit beings, whatever you want to call him, he's out there. And regardless of what, you know, any excess baggage that you may have gotten along the way or from your parents, maybe you were even a shotgun Sunday school student because your parents, you know, doggone it, the bees are going to continue until morale improves. You know, if they were that kind of person, okay, so what? They were that kind of person. Now it's your responsibility to deal with this entity because, you know, a few of us have less shopping days in front of us than we do behind us. I would prefer to remain in his jurisdiction and not a corporate jurisdiction identified by the government. So what happens is that the question that I believe that you were seeking to answer, Kent, have answered, was does an individual who identifies as a corporation or with all caps, do they now have other liabilities attached to them for with which also third-party damages can be exuded from? Is that correct?
Well, that's partially correct, but I was really looking at it also from the other side, and I don't know what Michael from Las Vegas' intent was total intent was in bringing it up, but I was looking at this also from the point of view that once you corrected your status by whatever method you did that, was there then some type of subrogatable interest? Not solely, as I think you just said, do you have a subrogatable interest if you identify as the all-cap corporation? That would be my part. To get, you know, I don't know if that's what Mike was trying to bring forth.
Now, in a moment, I'm going to ask Mike. I'm going to try to reiterate what you're saying. In a moment, I'm going to ask Mike if what I'm saying is kind of headed up the right direction of the topic that he was seeking for. And in this situation, are you possibly, if you use the term all caps, leaving yourself open and liable to responsibilities that could be written in books in a long time ago in a galaxy far, far away that you've never had a chance to look at, but that these lies did he say lies? I'm certain his lips were moving. But these laws could make you liable for that. They could even up to make it a capital crime. Michael, is this kind of the concern that you had, or would you like to expound and open up a little bit better on the direction you were heading?
Well, that's part of it. They make you a without full disclosure. They made you a. They bonded you. They sold the bond into the market. And everybody everybody wants the money from the bond. I want my money. It's not your money. The Treasury or the Fed put up the money, but the interest, just like your credit card. That you put nothing up, the bank put nothing up, but the bank is, you got $10,000 in credit, the bank got a $100,000 fractionalization loan from the Federal Reserve, which they're loaning out $90,000 without your knowledge because that's in an account set aside for you. And the birth certificate bond is the same thing. You have 18 years of unhindered interest compounding that belongs to you without your knowledge. And they're real good at what they do. What was his name? Mandel House with Wilson. Not one man in a million will figure out what we're doing.
Now, Frank Sly's banking only was purveyed until December 23rd, 2013. The Federal Reserve Act of 1913 was a 100-year contract with the U.S. government and in his final days of the Federal Reserve, because you understand that the Fed, the only thing that was American or about the Federal Reserve was Alan Greenspan, who was American. The only thing that was federal about it was his participation. But that Federal Reserve Act, when they introduced fractionalized banking, they also allowed banks to do commit fractionalized banking. And I use the word commit because it is a fraud and it is a crime to do fractionalized banking. They originally it was not, because originally the Federal Reserve Act until 1933, and they, oh, wait a minute, that's when the Federal Reserve Act was revised. It until then, they had gold to back it up, and they were literally backing you up like the FDIC insurance thing for, you know, $250,000 or $500,000, which now they've just recently admitted that an individual would get 1.87 cents on the dollar in the event of a banking crash, that if an individual institution should collapse, they're insured up to 50,000 or 250,000, whatever that particular banking institution contract was for. But if an entity, they finally admitted just recently here that if an entity like Chase Manhattan or Bank of America or Wells Fargo, any one of those were to collapse, they no longer have enough to cover that. And if there was a national collapse, the coverage that the FDIC, Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, would be able to handle cover is 1.87 cents per the dollar. But when Woodrow Wilson passed the Federal Reserve Act and signed it on December 21st, 1913, that created the Federal Reserve System, it was only a 100-year act. And now, its purpose was to change the way we do banking and create a whole metamorphosis where the American people would no longer be using currency with intrinsic value. They've done that. They've got us to the place where using fiat currency was in the next step from intrinsic value currency to a monetary system where entries were made in ledgers. And if all of a sudden they decided that you didn't really have that much, with a stroke of a pen, they could adjust that, if you catch my meaning. We've now got to that. There's no need for the Federal Reserve Act anymore.
Just when are they going to implement it? Because they're going to crash it.
Yeah. They. Some people say, well, this is horrible evil, and it's been doing, and look at what they've done just in the last so many years. Well, this evil's been going on for generations, not just centuries, but millennia. It says, the furnace for the gold and the crucible for the silver, and a man is tested by the praise he receives. This is not a battle of flesh and blood, but it's a battle of principalities and powers and high places for your soul and everyone else's. And long after we're gone, this melting pot called this third rock from the sun that we call planet Earth is still going to be here, boiling off and testing men's souls. And for the individuals that would like to seek the right life of Riley, the way coach, if you claim to be on the home team, but you're sitting in the end zone sucking on lemonade cooler reading the sports page, the away coach may do something really rude to you, like send a over with a fresh pitcher of lemonade in the latest sports page. But I promise you, you know, some people say, well, I know the head coach, I know God. So what? What do you mean, so what? Satan does also, he does war against him. It's which coach are you helping move the ball for yardage for? And that's what's critical. And no matter what happens, even when, you know, you read about some of those in the historical documents, that some of them, I call the Bible or the Torah, individuals, when they were totally imprisoned for the absolute wrong, most wrongest thing they could have been, the Father was still protecting them. And even when some of them were thrown into, a den with lions, the Father close their mouths. And the guy that they had thrown into the lion's den, you know, when the king of that country says, "Are you okay?" He says, "Oh, great king, live forever." He says, "They didn't eat you?" And he demanded to get him out of there, and he had the other, you know, there were, three individuals that they cast this huge, huge statue to, a bronze statue. And when they gave the signal, everyone was supposed to bow down and worship. These three would not. They were members of the king's court. They were some of his trusted, most trusted advisors. And they, the third in command pointed out that, Flinch, told you, hey, king, remember you signed this. Anybody that doesn't bow down when they, you know, in the music and the tar and the lyre and the timbrel and everything you start to play that, you know, they worship, you know, that they don't, they're to be put to death immediately. And, oops, holy broken tree feathers, Batman. You know, and the king lamented, but he had to do it. And they said the furnace was heated many, many times greater than it normally was. And it was heated so great that the men carrying these three individuals bound hand and foot to throw them in the furnace were consumed by the fire. And next point, the king is saying, hey, you guys, maybe I'm wrong, but we just threw three people in there, right? How come I see four? And the three walk out, and there's not even the smell of burnt singe on their clothing. You know, I mentioned that thing about the husband and wife driving into town, you know, and you know, we used to do this, and he looks at her and says, I haven't moved. I'm still here. You know, and it's the same thing with God. If you feel far from God, guess who moved? It says he inhabits the praises of his people. If you think that anything on this earth, this starry, miserable third rock from the sun we call planet Earth, is the most important thing, we might be overlooking something, and that's eternity, and that's the king. And if you want to get close to the king, it's real simple. In this case, it says he inhabits the praise of his people. You just get down on your knees, or you just raise your hand and say, thank you, Lord. Praise and honor be to you. He gets off on that stuff, just like the rock stars. Some of them, you know, and Olivia Neutron Bomb and, you know, like Bette Midler, they've all made public statements about how such a rush it is when they're on stage. And when they leave the stage, Olivia Newton-John says, it's such a letdown. I'm so depressed, you know, and Bette Midler commented that that's when she first started getting into recreational pharmaceuticals because she was trying to make up for it. You know, any of you ever see that movie or that TV show Stargate in the last in the season 8, 9, and 10, the bad guys are this group called Ori. They get jacked up and they get their power off the praises of the people and the worship of the people. Well, that is the basis for the fiction that they put in that comes out of reality. This intelligent designer of the third rock from the sun, not just the third rock, but the whole sun and the whole everything, he's like that. He loves you. Oh, tell me more about my eyes. You know, he just eats and digs up the praise. You want him to be close on your side, you know, and to come to your side, get close to you, just start praising him. He eats that stuff up and he loves it. He says, you know, you can see him screaming, saying, hey, look at my servant. Look at that. He's doing, look what he, hey, everybody gather around. He just grabs everybody in heaven. They're all looking at you. You know, you can't see them, but they can see you. All of this indenturement, et cetera. Yeah, maybe we make mistakes. Maybe we even screw up and make a contract that we shouldn't. The Father, if seek ye first the kingdom of heaven and his righteousness and everything else will be added on to you. You think that you've heard about some of the times sometimes when we've helped somebody that unbelievable results have came out of it. If somebody wants to point their finger at me, they're making a big mistake.
I count on grace a lot. And you can ask everyone that knows me, even just a little bit, they've probably heard the term, me use the phrase, God's grace strikes again in spite of me. And to that end, brother, yeah, you're right. We're creating unnecessary entanglements for ourselves. We need to stay away from it. And yes, there are a whole bunch of things that can go wrong by making innocent, naive mistakes, dumb, stupid mistakes like printing our names in all caps. Let's not go there.
Okay, we also have Ed from Beaver Falls has raised his hand. Go ahead, Ed.
A question about that. Hope I'm not going where you don't want to go, but I don't have a passport. Going to apply for one. Is that in an all caps name? And what would be expected from? What would I? What's channeling through the all caps name to me, if it is in an all caps name?
Well, right now, the aggregate entity that used to issue all the passports, and you look at everything that was issued before 1933, the names were always in dual. And after 1933, you looked at all the passports, and everything, as you looked at on the passport, is in all caps. And what happens is that the reason that it is because the corporation is doing business for the aggregate entity. They're saying that the aggregate entity, capital U, lowercase N-I-T-E-D, uppercase S, lowercase A, T-A-T-E-S, O-F, lower, uppercase A, lowercase M-E-R-I-C-A, they say that that went bankrupt and they filed bankruptcy in 1933 to do business for that aggregate entity. They started a corporation to take care of all the functions and things were necessary so that order would continue. It was a carefully planned changing the guard. Until the fire that took our place about 8 years ago, I used to have multiple copies of the Constitution that were all of the Constitution that was on file. The only one on file, two of them were given to me by my great-great-grandfather before he passed away, that still had the wax seal on it, and one that did not have the wax seal. That copies that were, he obtained back in the 20s. And the 16th Amendment in that Constitution was not the same as the 16th Amendment in our Constitution. His biggest point was that the one with the 16th Amendment about the income tax is all about the corporation, which means that the tax only applies to the corporation if you're an aggregate entity who has rights, life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness. That means also that you have the right to earn a living so you can buy shoes for your children, food for your wife, and a home for your family. And to that end, property ownership is not a privilege. It's a right.
It's a right as well, yeah.
And so think about this. If you can tax a right to the point where you can either take away the right or take away the individual's liberty to exercise that right, was the right still a right or is the tax being inappropriately applied?
Tax is inappropriately applied.
I would have to agree with you. To
which
that end,
came first?
The tax or the egg? I mean
the tax. Yeah, exactly.
At this juncture, when we talked about the
founding of our country and the fact that there was a little tea party there back in December 16, 1773. That was all over less than one penny of a tax. Of course, again, the penny was worth a lot more Latin back then. But the there are certain, if you, in most states, you go to buy a carton of eggs, there's no tax on it. But you go buy a carton of cigarettes and there's tax on it. You go buy a bunch of bananas and there's no tax on it. You go buy pastries like cream puffs and there are tax on it. What is the difference? Anybody?
Necessity versus non-necessity.
Exactly. That is exactly the correct answer. There are no ifs, ands, or buts, or very mattered and allowed. That is the exact answer. There, because it's a necessity of life, because you have to have it to live, it cannot be taxed. And so, presently, in multiple jurisdictions right now, there are pleadings and cases either being tried or being prepared where individuals were looking at overturning property taxation for reasons that are akin to a allodial title, but the individual must have their status corrected first. It cannot be, if an individual has a status where they're shown as a government asset, U.S. corporate asset, and all of a sudden the property is conveyed to them, or it achieve in court that certain things for individuals' inalienable rights are not, cannot be taxed, and then it's all of a sudden it's identified that they are taxable subjects. Can anybody see where we're going with that? And the effort that we just threw at the wall and lost. But if an individual,
go ahead. Yeah, we talked about several weeks ago or a couple of weeks ago the issue about the fruit, what you termed it, fruit of a poisonous tree, with U.S. citizens having held title, if a abstract of title was done, having held title on certain land from back when it was a land patent, and whether or not the other side could raise the question about the fact that their serfs or U.S. citizens held the property in between. And you said that that was something you'd have to think about. Is that, are you still in the thinking process on that? As long as you bring this up now, I'm asking.
Well, the thank you. Thank you for re-raising that question. Thank you. Title in allodium is title in allodium. Whether the person is a serf or not, the title in allodium is still a title in allodium. While an individual possesses that, if they're not a serf, they nobody else can lay claim. There's a in the event that they're considered, unless there's a subjugation due to the fact that they are a serf, that a third party can be involved in it. The U.S. government, until that person can get their status corrected, they cannot actually truly say that they hold the title in. Although title in allodium is title in allodium, but they can't exercise the privileges because their owner, their owners will not allow that, or because they're property of someone else. Now, there's another approach that we've been working on. Three people and I have been working on this since 1977, because of a lawsuit with the state of California over a little piece of beachfront property in California, and the fact that the great-grandparents, who are now passed away, held original allodial title to the property. And what happened was that rights as an individual to own property
regardless of the fact that the land patent or the covenants that was already given by the land grant gave the individual owning that property the sovereign right to be the sole taxing authority, and that is where the penny dropped in that lawsuit. And by the way, we did prevail, but the proceeds of that have been sealed under in a contractual agreement. And should the and anybody that was a party to that violate that, the heirs and heirs apparent lose all privileges and benefits and rights to the proceeds from the agreement. So with that, I'm going to ask in advance before anybody raises their hand and says, tell us about that, John. I'm going to tell you right now, I wish I could. In fact, I was one of the people that was doing the original research on that that helped make it happen. But the families who were the heirs and heirs apparent and the beneficiaries, they entered into a contract that I have never violated and I will not violate so that they can keep the benefits that they've gotten out of that. But one thing I think that was most important from that that lawsuit, and at the time, that may have been the time when I was living in Southern California, and I may have even been at law at USC during that time. There was some things that came to the surface that if an individual is been endowed by their creator with certain inalienable rights, and it says among these, meaning that those are three from a larger pool of rights, or the right to life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness. To have happiness and liberty, you have to be able to earn an income. You also have to be able to own property. And so property tax and income tax, which are the two things that Satan knows are the easiest way to control an individual in a gubernatorial situation, they're unconstitutional because Article 9 of the Constitution makes it very, very clear that when it says, and it's it makes no bones about it, when you look at Article 9, it's one of the shortest articles in the Constitution, but it says the enumeration of the Constitution of certain rights shall not be construed to deny or disparage others retained by the people. Whoa, heavy alert. Wait a minute, John. It says others retained by the people? Is that what you said, John? Yeah, I did. Thank you for bringing that up. These rights are preeminent and predate the Constitution. And that's identified by the Declaration of Independence. So the rights to own property and earn a living, they are rights. Just because it wasn't specifically enumerated there doesn't mean that they don't exist. And we've had multiple court battles that to date, we were about one out of three of these engagements. We've been coming up with some very positive results in some cases where individuals have been given letters that basically create a contractual agreement, a contractual bind that between the Treasury Department and the individuals that indicate that neither they nor and on about a third or half of these individuals, we've got the grace added in there that neither they nor their posterity, their children's posterity, or anybody, and the Marians are not required to file a 1040. And they that was a stipulation of settling out of court. And we did so contractually. And every single time that happens, the prosecutor has always demanded that as part of this, we're going to demand absolute secrecy and privacy on this. The families, not yet to date, have I had one that might have been willing to be counted as number 57 and said, no, we're going to fight you into court and we're going to no, this is the with the American people, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. I'm sorry. We're not going to just take this just for ourselves. Number 57 is a little bit of a toughie. That's a tough one to stand up and be willing to give up the life of Riley for what's right, or risk the life of Riley for what's right. Please continue.
Could you qualify something you said for the benefit of everybody? In the past, we talked about the importance of the correction of status, but there was an exception with Bernie's program that one didn't need to do that. But as this program moves forward and we talk about title and allodium and land patents, and we talk about the CRT or the corporation sold either being you as the beneficiary or you as being the corporate sole and vice versa, if one has not corrected their status, then basically I think what I hear you saying is that they're going to have a problem with the allodium title. Now, I took it to mean in the past when we said, well, the property could be in a CRT or a corporation sole, that one didn't necessarily have to have corrected their status in order to hold the property that way. But you're saying it all goes back to the living, breathing man or woman, or I think that's what you're saying. And so, therefore, if that living, breathing man or woman has not corrected their status, this, when it comes to the land patents and the allodium title, you're still likely to have some kind of problems when you deal with the CRT or the corporation sole in trying to hold that property. Is that now a correct statement on my part, or is there still some confusion on my part?
That's a very good question. Thank you. Did you want an answer?
I do want an answer, definitely.
Okay. Title in allodium is title in allodium, and means that it says in the land grant or the conveyance, whether it's a Spanish or French or whoever's, that the when it says the individual when the property owner, when it comes to taxation, the owner of the property is the sole and final authority of taxation, taxing authority. That means that whoever owns it, even if you have not had your status corrected, whoever owns it has title in allodium. Now, somebody made a comment and asked a question about possible subrogation of a third party when their relationship existed. There was a comment about having an individual misrepresented and their status not corrected. Could the third party come in and claim rights and privileges to participate? Yes, they can. Until that individual cuts those golden cords, or they actually, these aren't silver, they're not even silver, they're not even copper, but it cuts those strings of entanglement. Now, we're going to talk about a completely separate situation. An individual, okay, and I'll read the text verbatim, that we hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, and they are endowed by their Creator with certain inalienable rights, among these is the right to life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness. This one, as long as the individual, I believe, and we, and I wish I could say, I got your answer for you, totally, no problem. I've been working many, many years on this, and I've gotten to the place, and if anybody says, he pulled himself up by his own bootstraps, horse feathers. I've had the honor and the privilege of judiciary that have helped me, gowns and gavels, that some of them have helped me through my life, that some of them have known me since I was their paper boy. And as an 8-year-old paper boy. So I've known some of these individuals for maybe a year or two, or maybe even 3 or 4. But they're the ones that have taken what they've learned and given it to me. They've learned the hard way, they've given it to me the easy way. And I've realized that even though we may not possess title in allodium, and there's two precious little ladies Jennifer and Anita, that are such a thought-provoking moment for me that every time they ask their, what somebody might say, oh, they're just that. They're just a couple of little old ladies, you know, they got ignorance and they're just kind of, you know, fishing in whatever pond. They've been so thought-provoking that I've explored and researched out some things that it's quite possible that there may be a way to establish a title similar to Elodium based exclusively on not a foreign entity's conveyance or of a land grant, but on the fact that they are a God-given possessor of a human soul, and they are living and breathing, and they've got their status corrected, that they may have similar status. And to that end, and the way we get to that is a very, very different route. You know, and I've already actually explained that. You know, if somebody can tax your income to the point where they take away, demand that they take away your income or your, take away your liberty so you can't make your income because you didn't pay the tax, is the tax being unlawfully construed or mismanaged, or was the right never a right? And it's the same thing with property tax. I believe that you have the right to own property. I've been working on putting together anything and everything I learned about property before, especially in law school back in the 70s and 80s, I've had to set it on the shelf and clear my desk so that I can research and research the new material that I'm working on now, when I've come to realize, and in no small part, to the precious questions of Anita and Jennifer, those sweeties, those two killer sweeties, the way they ask questions, it has brought me to thought-provoking. And I think the Father in Heaven, many of you have heard a story about this Balaam guy who is a prophet that this king of this other country heard that anytime he prophesied against somebody, they lost, and Israel won. And this guy says, he sends an emissary over to talk to Balaam. He says, hey, come over here. I'm going to pay you a whole bunch of nickels, you know, and you know, you got to, you know, just do a favor for me. He wants him to prophesy against Israel, you know, that he keeps losing the war against, you know, and all of a sudden, this guy, this prophet's donkey stops and he starts slapping the donkey and spanking it, you know, and giving it with a crack with a switch, you know, and gets off and all of a sudden he's in an argument with the donkey, and the donkey's talking to him, and he's arguing with the donkey. He's so far gone, he doesn't realize that he's in an argument with an animal. You know, and finally the animal says, why are you looking at me? You know, and he turns around, and there's a paraphrase, and there's this cherubim there standing in this big fiery angel standing in the way. You know, and it's, whoops, holy kitty litter, Batman. I would have been a dead man. He realized the donkey saved his life. But sometimes the Father has to grab, I feel like he grabs Balaam's donkey by the tail and dips it in liquid nitrogen and slugs me over the head with it. And I'm standing there on the street corner looking at all these shards of thawing donkey flesh around me, scratching my head going, what happened? I'm about that dense. The Father uses other people in a most amazing and wonderful way to help me. Those two precious little souls, Anita and Jennifer, the Father's used them in some really great ways, and they've triggered some paths of search and research that I never would have otherwise considered. You know, and even people like you, when you ask the questions you've been asking, tonight, there's four thought-provoking questions that I've written down since we've been talking to you. And, that sounds juicy. I'm going to go check that out. So, well, you're being counted in that number with those two sweeties.
Thank you. I appreciate your comments, and I want to add something here. that I had a discussion with a paralegal this afternoon regarding people who can't obtain a passport because of child support, and he's been working on these issues for 30 or 40 years now. And while he hasn't been totally successful with the passport issue, he was talking about how we need to think in a broader range regarding debt and the Constitution, and we talked about the correction of status, et cetera. I brought this to Mike's attention so that we could set up a, you know, a private conference call regarding this. But all of this goes back to the principle of that we have to take a broader approach here and think about other ways we may do this. And I think this is very interesting what you say about the possession of the human soul and being a living, breathing person and their right to hold land. So I compliment you for thinking beyond beyond the fox.
All right. Kent, I've got some things I want to share with you in the group on tonight that you need to grab a hold of.
Mike, Michael, could I interrupt for just one moment?
Please do.
Please get a hold of Michael. Set an appointment for the three of us.
Let's start in the works, John.
Thank you. Okay. Request lines are open. Next victim, please. I mean, next caller. I mean, next customer.
All right. So let me just share some things that may bring some more truth or a better sense to this idea about corporation soul owning a piece of land in Elodium versus a United States citizen owning a piece of land in Elodium versus a American national owning a piece of land in Elodium. The United States citizen is, quote, property in a franchise of the United States, end quote. And though that property and franchise may own that land, the United States owns the owner of that land. And by default, the United States owns that land. It will slip back to them. A slave cannot own property. Number two, a man who has or a woman who has corrected their status is actually the founder of a co-founder of this nation and is one that the declaration talks about all men are created equal, which brings me to the second point, which is, before we get to that, the corporation's soul is a religious entity under ecclesiastical law. I've heard it said, I haven't heard John's response to this, but I've heard it said that ecclesiastical law is actually higher law than civil law. But anyways, yeah. I don't want to really get into that tonight. The next step is something that's going to get me in trouble with several people on this call, but as my young son used to tell me when he was a teenager, it is what it is, Dad, it is what it is. And that is this. The founding fathers were educated men. They spoke multiple languages. I think all of them basically spoke Greek. And there is a difference in the Greek language and also in the Hebrew between a man and a human. When they said all men are created equal, they were in reference to Adam kind. The of the three races, there's one that blushed, had a ruddy complexion, Adam kind. And at that time, they were holding all men, actually all Europeans, if you would, being equal. And now that sounds racist. Sorry, it is, but that's what was looked at that time. They didn't say that all human beings were created equal. They said all men are created equal. So, and if you know of a researcher, his name was Dan Metter. John, did you know Dan Metter back in the 1990s? He died in 2003, I think, at 52 years of age.
Only met him at a conference once.
Okay.
Briefly.
So you know who I'm talking. So if you've ever read his papers, he made a great effort to research. And again, those of you on this call that are Americans of African descent that have talked to me in the past, you know where I'm at, exactly where I'm at in regards to relationships with men and women and other people. The point being is that the Founding Fathers, as racist as it sounds today, was not considered racist in that day, and they often would say in documents of the founding of each state, from a territory to a state, they would talk about this or that for white people. Again, I don't want to sound Aryan, but that's what those written words were. When Dan Metter passed, I have yet to find someone who has a collection of his work. I had the privilege of seeing it and having my hands on it at one time, but never considered it something that I needed to hold on to. I thought it would be a resource that I could always go back to, and I was wrong there. But we need to put things into context. When the Founding Fathers were dealing with the issue of slavery, they truly were not considering the then Americans of African descent to be on par with Americans of European descent. That was not their consideration. And the civil rights that they evolved into came into place simply because they could not give them constitutional rights based upon their birthright. And these are very sad things that we talk about today, but this is the reality. Now, by correcting your status, there is a way through the law that actually brings us on all under equal ground, whether we're man or human. Point being is that it's something that we need to study and look at for what it is and put it into a lawful perspective so that we can govern ourselves accordingly. And then my last question actually goes back to John here. A little birdie told me that there were issues with regards to property tax in downtown Las Vegas and also in downtown Los Angeles. Is that any relation to the works that you were doing back in the 70s?
By the way, there's nothing little about Bernie, and he keeps giving me the raspberries about that. And he keeps saying that I needed to have pursued that into the downtown L.A. issue, and we didn't.
Mm-hmm.
Does that answer your question?
Yeah, I just need further clarity because it's confusing to me. We also have on this call tonight Tommy from Baton Rouge and Tommy from Eau Claire. So probably like to add comments. Go ahead, brothers.
All right. I'm Tommy from Baton Rouge. I forgot about my question now. It's been so long.
I've been on hold so long, I forgot who I called.
I got you. I just wanted to remind you about my conference call tomorrow at 10.
Yeah, we're going to need to probably do that at 11. Can you work with that at 11?
Yes, that's fine.
Okay. Yeah, I ended up with a doctor's appointment being dropped in. I got it. So my humble apologies. I got a call this morning that it's if we can do 11, yeah, let's do that. Also, there's still some good flights. Well, we'll talk about it tomorrow.
Okay, thanks. Okay, bye.
And Tom from Eau Claire.
Gentlemen, how are we doing?
Hey. Oh, I love it. By the way, I haven't finished going over your letter yet.
That's fine. I'm tweaking it. Every time I jump the gun, it seems like the Lord has got some a little better avenue for us to go over, making progress. But what is there some time later tomorrow or something Thursday when we could speak for a little bit then? I guess I was just checking on time.
I would like to consider Friday.
Friday's going to be a little bit harder for me.
Okay, then let's back it up to Thursday then.
Okay, anytime Thursday would work.
Because tomorrow I've got some high priority students that we're trying to save both their property and their liberty. There are some that's their liberties at stake and some of their properties at stake. And so
No, brother, there's nothing more important than cheese. You know, it's just cheesemakers up here. That's number one priority, but I'll forgive you this time.
You're so very gracious, my honored brother. Okay, you can stay.
Okay, that's great. Just let me know or let Michael or something, and I'll have the FOIA. I'm working on the FOIA tomorrow. I'll have the FOIA for the district attorney. I got a good one.
Excellent. And as soon as you have a moment to run it past police, yeah, we're looking forward to seeing your rough on that one.
Yeah. Okay. I'll get them into you tomorrow and then Thursday or something, or Saturday. Thursday or Saturday would work.
Thank you very much.
Okay. Thank you. And thank you for letting us know that the Lord Jesus is in control and everything ties to the way he has this plan for it. So I always appreciate that. That's encouraging. God bless you.
Hey, let's face it. The boss is still boss. He's larger in charge. He's sovereign. There aren't any other rules.
Yep. Okay. Thank you, everybody.
All right. Thank you. Any closing comments, Brother John?
Ladies and gentlemen of the jury, Your Honor, and esteemed onlookers, yes, you're right. Everything that the prosecutor would say about me is true. However, I'm begging grace in the manner and form of one who was in the same form of the Melchizedek, the high priest, and he promised that he would always be begging grace for me and forgiveness in spite of my poor, wretched, sinful self. To that end, I beg your grace and your mercy, and that if you can look on me with the love and mercy that he does, there is nothing more that I can hope to ask for in the eyes of either the jury, the judge, or my fellow person. Without that grace, there is not enough in me to do enough good to balance against the evil that I have in just in my heart, let alone that I've committed in my life. That one evil act can never be washed away by any amount of good. It can only be forgiven. And if I beg your grace, please forgive me. Count me amongst those that are covered by your love and your grace. Thank you.
All right. Both Kent and Michael from Lost Wages have raised their hands, so I unmuted both of them.
Okay. Kent, let me just quickly. Land grant, if you had a land grant from the King's Authority, that would be about the highest land grant you could get then, isn't it?
With some qualifications.
The King of England.
With some qualifications. There is something called the Enablement Act, in which what they use to it designates how a state is bought into the Union. For example, the Enablement Act that bought California into the Union, or Old California, designated and assigned that all pre-existing land grants were recognized by the U.S. government in their fullness and their entirety. Almost the same text was used in the land grant that bought Texas into the Union both times. And there was even some things that the Enablement Act, not just in the first and the second, but also recognized that because Texas was its own individual country before it joined the Union, it had the right to secede, mean leave, without giving any notice or anything at all. The Enablement Act that covers the property, whether it's Wichita, Kansas, or Sioux Falls, South Dakota, or Salmon River, Idaho, that Enablement Act that covers that property and the land grant work together.
Okay, because I have pre-Revolutionary War grant. Anyway, for Michael.
Who? Now, where'd the grant come from?
It came from a military authority of the king.
Of which king? As
King George.
Whoa. Heavy alert. Can you scan that and send me a copy of it? I have somebody that can do some research on it, that I might be able to give you some more information on that. There's somebody that he has absolutely demanded that he remains anonymous because he gets a ongoing flood and plethora of information requests. I'm one of the few people that I feel honored that he entertains my questions. If you have a copy of that grant, I would love to get a copy of it, please.
I've got my brother in Eaton Rapids, Michigan. I'm up here now because I was on a job at GM, but he's going to be getting that together. And as soon as he's got it in his possession, we'll have copies, and I'll send it to you. And for Michael, Dan Menard, what was the guy's name? Yeah,
Dan Menard.
I read his papers 4 or 5 years ago. And
where'd you find him?
Oh, God, it's been so long ago. I'd have to go back to my old phones, charge them up, and start pulling up all the screenshots.
It is worth it to me, please.
Okay. And for John, my final thing is I'll be number 57. I'm 73 years old. I don't care about it. This is more important than anything else.
How old are you?
73.
Just a young spring chicken.
Yeah, they all look at me on a job like, you're that old? Well, yeah, I was here before you were flipping burgers at McDonald's, boy.
Yeah, you know what? I have a lot of people that, you know, they say, well, you're not old enough to, how old do you think I am? And you know what? I'm just starting to get some salt and pepper on the sidewalls. You know, I don't have white walls yet, but it's a, but there ain't no snow on the roof yet. And, I would be honored to be number 57 right beside you.
Yep.
Thank you.
All right. Well, that's turn it over to Kent.
Okay. Thank you. Two things, John. First of all, thank you for your heartfelt, thought-provoking comments and all the research you do and looking beyond what this shows on the face. And secondly, on the Saturday night call with Bernie, I asked a question regarding CRTs and leasehold interests, and it was agreed that this was a John question and that I would bring it up on Tuesday. I was asking about a CRT or a corporation sole, actually, holding a leasehold interest and whether there would be any benefit in that and whether or not all parties would have to be notified that it was changing from the man or the woman to the CRT or the corporation sole. Now, when I structure something, I basically look at three things. I look at, you know, what are the tax ramifications, the liability ramifications, and the estate or surrogate and probate ramifications. So I don't know. When I think about a CRT holding a leasehold interest, I don't generally see in those three parameters that I usually use, I don't see any benefit in that. But I'm wondering, as far as being able to tie people up in litigation when there's going to be, when one holds a leasehold interest on a property that's likely to change hands, whether there would be any benefit in another entity to make this more complicated for someone else, whether there would be a benefit in that leasehold interest being put in the other entity, and whether or not somebody could actually stop that if there are no terms and conditions in that lease that would stop that. So I'd appreciate your comments on it, if you have any comments at the time.
Thank you. I can think of a couple. You ready?
Okay. Yep.
Okay. When
a property is held by an entity, do you sell the property from one entity to another or to an individual, or do you assign control of the entity, convey control of the entity to another trustee or another beneficiary?
Mm-hmm.
Do you understand the question?
Well,
when you if I have 4 square feet, a 2x2 plot that's just big enough for a mailbox in South Las Vegas or North Henderson, and I put it in a corp sol or a CRT, I want to give it to Dan Nicholson. I want to convey it to Dan Nicholson. Do I sell the property from the corp sol to Dan Nicholson, or do I convey the corp sol, or do I assign the new trustee or the new entity controlling the corp sol as Dan?
Okay, I understand what you're saying, but that wasn't the point of my question. I mean, that's a good point to raise, but that wasn't the question. The question is, when you have a leasehold interest on a piece of property, but you have no other control of that property, you don't own it, you have no other interest in it with a mortgage or whatever, you just have simply a leasehold interest. Is there any benefit in having the leasehold interest instead of being held by a man or woman who may or may not have corrected their status? Is there any benefit in having that leasehold interest being held by a CRT or a corporation sole? Because when I look at the three parameters that I gave you already, taxes, liability, and estate purposes, I don't see any benefit that jumps out at me. However, I do see, if litigation were to ensue over that leasehold interest when there becomes a new owner of the property, whether that be an entity or another man or woman, certain disputes coming up based on that leasehold interest, whether or not holding that in a CRT or a corporation sole would make more sense than it being held simply by a man or woman. And if so, would one have just like the ability to change if you had a mortgage under, what is it, the St. Germain ruling that Michael was talking about, that you could change that mortgage to a trust and the bank could not stop you and they couldn't accelerate the payments? So, again, is there any benefit with a CRT or a corporation sole holding that leasehold interest, if nothing more, to make it more complicated for anybody who would dispute what the rights of that leaseholder are and getting into extensive litigation over it?
Okay. I'm going to go back to if you have a property 2 square feet, is it wiser to convey an individual or to an individual or to sell to an individual or convey the office of authority of the corp sol?
Mm-hmm.
Which one is wiser to do? Okay. Now, if some entity attempts to attack that, and it's conveyed to an individual, is the individual that it was conveyed to, for whatever reason, and here's where that was going, the mailbox. That mailbox happens to be a brick stone mailbox, and somebody not coloring between the lines and sleeping on the road actually hits that stone mailbox, and the passenger is killed in the car. And I'm not actually pulling this one out of thin air, although the property was a little bit larger than 2 square feet. But they sue the owner of the property. Okay? If the owner of the property is a corp sol, that's where it stops. And if that's all that's held by the corp sol, then that stops. Then that's where the litigation ends. But if it's an individual,
they do all these searches and assets and everything else to find out where the individual's at, and they find out that he owns, has interest in this corporation, this LLC, this McDonald's, these four properties, two ski boats, a runabout, and a partridge in a pear tree, then they have fun going after the assets and the extended assets that they can go through. Now, if an individual holds a lease on that property and there's an event that transpires there, then maybe there's a fire where some third party's goods are damaged, okay, or lost. It stops at the lease by the corp sole or the CRT, and it's wise that the CRT, especially if this is a property of any note or any substance, it's wise that it's the only thing in that CRT or corp sole. Now, anytime there's a dispute, they can always, individuals, lately the jurisprudence is not jurisprudence anymore. It's a trade. And the stock and trade is to make money. And to do that, these entrepreneurs, they're not dumb as doorposts. They like to make money. And to that end, they figure out creative ways to create liability for anything related to that individual. So what will happen is that if an individual owns it, they will always try to figure out what that individual's assets are. And there's some states that have what are called like widow laws. I happen to live in one. And you cannot re-encumber a property that's homesteaded with a second trustee or a second mortgage because once you purchase it by law, you have to pay it off for the sake of the wife or someday the potential widow, and you cannot re-encumber it. That's something that's like a Texas law also. When you have a corp sole or a CRT holding the lease on that property and something goes wrong, they can be a beneficiary and sue whoever they were leasing it from. But somebody who comes and if you're leasing it, if an aggregate entity that has breath of life and a pulse and can fog a mirror owns it, they may try to imply some type of fault. But if it's a corp sole or CRT, if it's a CS or CRT, then the liability stops right there. The individual isn't liable for that. They also, there's ways that if you have a lease and you're subleasing and somebody becomes disgruntled and they, you know, that's a layer of insulation between you and them, because it's the CRT or CS that holds the property. CS and CRTs are very, very good when an individual is assailed by another entity or an individual or municipality. And when I say municipality, that goes all the way up to the Treasury Department. Stopping the liability right there. So all the liability challenges that you can conceive, most of the ones that I can conceive cease at the CRT or the corp sole.
Thank you. So would you say that a CRT that was held by someone who had or had not changed their status could make that CRT the leaseholder, just the same as the analogy I gave with the mortgage, that one could not stop, so the party holding the lease or owning the property could not stop someone from transferring that lease to the CRT or the corporation sole?
Right.
You would agree with that. Okay.
Thank you. You're welcome.
All right. John, any closing comments? I mean, you've already made that before, but anything else? And we're going to say goodnight.
I want to thank you all. It's an honor and privilege to serve beside you. Thank you. Good evening.
All right. Thank you all. Remember to come tomorrow night when Herr Slevin Mr. Slevin will be sharing with you the benefits of his uniquely assembled LLC and how it works for you if you are an employee, how to change that status to be a worker for the LLC, and also make more money at it than you were as an employee, and allow your employer, former employer, to make more money or have less expense by operating through the LLC than to operate through you. It's an important call, so be there or be square. Good night, everybody. Until then, be well.
The conference is now completed. Goodbye. Welcome to the conference. Please enter the conference ID, followed by the pound key. Thank you. Guest ID accepted. Thank you.